अल्लाह ही अल्लाह किया करो, दुख न किसी को दिया करो। जो दुनिया का मालिक है, नाम उसी का लिया करो।
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Sisters and brothers, let's begin the session. I'm sorry, we're running a few minutes late. Sister Ingrid Mattson was speaking in another panel, and that panel has yet to conclude. So we are waiting, and she will be joining us in a few moments. In the meantime, we decided, without wasting any time, we should start the panel right away. Let me introduce briefly the speakers for this panel, and then I will request them to make their presentations. Dr. Ingrid Mattson, as probably most of you know, is the Vice President of the Islamic Society of North America. She teaches at the Hartford Seminary. She has a PhD from the University of Chicago, my alma mater. And she's a very well-known activist, community leader, and a very highly sought-after speaker on topics related to Islam all over the United States. I have heard her in many conferences and many seminars, and have been considerably enriched by her thoughtful comments, and we hope to that she joins us soon. Our second speaker in this panel is our brother Farid Asak, a native of South Africa, a very dear brother, very dear friend, scholar, and an activist, and a man who embodies, both in his ideas and in his life experience, all the three elements of the title of this panel: Islam, activism, and social justice. He is a devout Muslim, a relentless activist, and a fighter for social justice for all. Those of you who know him, you also know that he was in the forefront of the struggle against the apartheid in South Africa, and personally suffered many times as a result of his joining the struggle against the white rule. He was very close to Nelson Mandela. He was imprisoned, and he suffered many other things as a result of his activism. For an Islamic scholar, he has an unusual and a highly advantageous background, in the sense that he had the opportunity of studying classical Islamic sciences in a traditional madrasa in Pakistan, one of the most well-known madrasas in Karachi, as well as in the Western universities. After completing his Dars-e-Nizami, or classical Islamic curriculum, in Pakistan, he obtained his PhD in Quranic hermeneutics from England. He is author of several books, and all of them emphasize the core values of Islam, the two core values of Islam, Tawheed and social justice, compassion, struggle, and the message of Islam of liberation and emancipation. Emancipation of those people and liberation of those people who live on the margins of society, and who have been discriminated and oppressed on the basis of race, on the basis of color, on the basis of class, and on the basis of gender, are on the basis of other inequities that the oppressive systems impose on them. Brother Fareed Ishaq is a very popular speaker and very passionately believes and acts on what he says. I can testify that at least two people, members of this audience, who came to me and they told me that they are here only because Fareed Ishaq. So I can assure you, Brother Fareed, at least there are two people who will listen to you very carefully. There is a third one. Thank you very much. The third speaker was to be here, my very dear brother and friend, Dr. Suleiman Nayan. Unfortunately, he couldn't make it for this panel. He is at present, instead of talking about social justice and activism, is doing activism and performing social work, helping to rescue some people who are stranded in Louisiana and Mississippi as a result of the tragedy of Hurricane Katrina. I called him yesterday and he was busy in locating and trying to relocate some people he knew and some he didn't know. So we miss him, but we pray for him that God bless his efforts. Before I request the panelists to, in fact only one panelist is here, to begin making their presentations, let me also recognize the young man who actually proposed the panel, put it together, contacted the speakers individually, and got it approved by the ISNA program committee. He should be sitting somewhere here in the front row, and despite the fact that we live in the same house, he sent me an email informing me that he has proposed a panel and he has suggested that I be the chair and the moderator.
This is typical Pakistani nepotism.
Exactly. I thought he was too embarrassed, having committed the nepotism in reverse of the first degree, to have verbally communicated and extended that invitation to me. But anyway, I just wanted to mention that this panel is his work. I do not want to stay between you and Brother Fareed Ishaq, so I'll request him to make his presentation. But just one more remark. After the panel was approved, I received an email from Brother Fareed, and he said that he told me that the panel has been approved and you are the moderator. My immediate reaction was that I wrote to him, "You know, Fareed, it's not easy to moderate a panel in which you are a speaker." And I also told him that I'm afraid that my reputation as a moderate Muslim will be tarnished forever if we are seen together on the same podium. I took the risk, and I hope and pray that inshallah the risk will be worth it. Thank you very much.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the gracious, the dispenser of grace. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I've been based in the United States for about 3 years. I have been quite familiar with ISNA. It is the first time that I've been invited to speak at an ISNA gathering. And in my preparing for my talk, I chatted to a number of people. Another colleague from South Africa, Imam Rashid Umar, chatted to him. The voice does get up in a minute or two, relax. Yes, it was the same response we had in the earlier panel. And I chatted to I also asked Junaid about a couple of things. And then there was an argument or a debate in my own head about, do I speak in a way that I should get invited again? Or because, the truth be told, it's been a bit difficult to get me to speak at an ISNA gathering. In the past, I mean, panels that my name was on were turned down. So I am here for the first time, and when I chatted to Sayyid Said yesterday, and he said, oh, it's wonderful to have had you here. So I said, haha, aakhir mein Junaid aur Mumtaz saab ke chalake ke mein pahunch gaya yahan par. It's more Junaid than Mumtaz's cunning that I had arrived here. Anyway, here I am, so I must be careful. Not that I'm desperate to speak in order to be invited again. There is a problem sometimes in that. We need to learn to speak with wa mu'idhata lil hasana, kind words and so on, beautiful words. But at the same time, we also have to speak our truths. We have to speak our truth regardless on whether we get invited again or whether we don't get invited. Anyway, so here I am. Here I am talking about issues of social justice and Islam. Our context of living in the United States today. I often think, I heard a talk, I was in a talk just in this previous panel, and I thought it was an excellent talk that I listened to. I did think that the speaker was in some ways a bit too theoretical for the audience. And so I want to try to reduce, without engaging in reductionism, I want to reduce much of what I want to say to three stories that I want to tell, and hopefully people will remember these stories and the implications of these three stories. The one story I titled The Poisoned Chalice, or The Poisoned Cup. Junaid did say I must explain what I mean by it, but hopefully people will get the stories as I move along. And so here we are sitting in a classroom, and the teacher is a very strong, very powerful teacher, bit of a sensitive fellow, gets upset easily and so on, makes sure who his friends are, who he likes in class, who he doesn't like in class. Has a cup that is often used as a coffee cup, but for those who are more aware of how things work in the world, it's a poisoned chalice, it's a poisoned cup. And one day, one of the students in class, a difficult student, a troublesome student, does something terrible in the teacher's cup. I leave it up to your imagination what the student does in the teacher's cup. The teacher gets to the cup, drinks the cup, oh God, oh. The teacher is furious. And the whole class now has to suffer. And the whole class has to write 1,000 times, 100,000 times, I shall not pee in my teacher's cup. I shall love human rights. I shall love peace. I shall love democracy. The whole class is put on trial for what one particular student did. But of course, compound the problem is that the teacher suspects that some of the pupils in the class actually celebrated when they realize how offended the teacher was at discovering what had happened to his poisoned cup. And there was some kind of rejoicing when what happened on September the 11th. As it is, this class is a remedial class for people who haven't quite adjusted. The Muslim world is not quite civilized. The Muslim world is eternally on probation. They have to prove their credentials as people that are into civilized values, into human rights, into gender equality, and. So it's a class for slow learners. There are a couple of people who have escaped from the class into the real class. And the real class is the West. The real class is America. And there we learn to dress properly. We learn to talk properly. We learn to use underarm, deodorant. We don't smell like those other people in the remedial class. And so the teacher is there to teach. But the teacher is not a very good teacher. The teacher has two jobs. The other job of the teacher is as a demolisher of the values and the faiths of that classroom. The teacher comes from outside. We do not interrogate ideas of learning and books and education, stuff written by, say, Paul Goodman or Ivan Illich or Paulo Freire. Then what is education about? No. The teacher is there to civilize these kids. She comes from the city. These kids are in the rural area, and to civilize these barbarians. The agenda of the teacher is never critiqued. We are desperate to become acceptable to the teacher. And you know what those kinds of students look like when they're desperate to, what they call it, brown nosing in America? When they want to brown nose each other and get into the good books of the teacher? You know how some of our students, how they behave when they are indifferent to assisting other students around them as long as they can get into the good books of the teacher? And so the task often of the Muslim intellectual is to become a prefect, to become a monitor, to manage those Muslims on behalf of the teacher. But about the agenda of the teacher, the second job of the teacher as a bulldozer of the values of my people, as a bulldozer of the humanity, of all of people, that we do not critique. And in its place, the substitution of the notion of insan, of human beings, as responsible to God, as human beings as sacred, in the place of all of this, the teacher is desperate to create homo economicus, human beings as essentially an economic animal. And so you are a consumer. You're not a human being, a returnee to God, a person with a sacred spirit. No, no, no. You are a human being, you are a consumer. And so our struggle becomes, how do we become peaceful, obedient, well-behaving consumers? But the teacher has an agenda. And that agenda, we do not have the courage to critique and to interrogate. The second story that I want to tell is the story of the ideal man. When I went to Notre Dame, there's Rashid Umar again. When I went to Notre Dame, I mean, Notre Dame has the Irish. It's the Irish. And when they play, was it basketball, Rashid? What was it? It was football, sorry, I never know. Yes, it was football. When they play Purdue, I mean, there is one of the rituals that they have when they play Purdue. It's the Irish army or the Irish band. And I was amazed. All of the people in the Irish band were 6'2". You had to be 6'2" to be in this band. And this is the ideal human being in America today. 6'2". And so if you have a girl, it's kind of nice and so on to have a girl. Better, you know, if you have a boy, unconsciously better. If you have two boys, and the one is into piano playing, and ballet and so on, oh gosh, you know, I hope he becomes a real boy later on, but I can kind of put up with it for the moment. And when you have a boy that's kind of thin and skinny and so on, you know, no, it's kind of okay, you know, all my kids are this thing and so on. If you have a boy who really kind of and 6'2" and so on, you know, mashallah, you know, mashallah, really mashallah. And so the ideal person in this society is a male. And the ideal person in this society is a 6'2" male. And you should be having problems with yourself if you're much below that 6'2". And 6'3", 6'4" is also okay. But then, in this family, you have one person growing up, mashallah, really tall, you know, he's in 16, 17 now, really tall, mashallah. And then the child grows, 6'6", 6'7", 7', 8', huh? What do you have on your hands now? You have a serious problem on your hands. You must, if you care about this child, you must seek treatment for this child. You have a huge problem on your hand. Even in an ideal society where machoism and good bodies are valued, if you do not seek treatment for this child, the compelling question becomes one, how do I satisfy the appetite of this child? But the family has a limited budget. The earth has limited resources. There is only so much gas in the world. There is only so much food in the world. When this one child consumes the budget of the entire family, every child in that house must ask, how do I reduce my appetite in order to fulfill the appetite of this other person? The dream of children in that house, in their perversity, maybe how can I become as tall as that child? But that is not an ethical response. It is not an Islamic response to become as tall as that other person. That other person is sick. The United States has become big. Very, very big. The powerful in this world have become very, very powerful. And in the quest to satisfy the appetite of the United States, the only question that Muslims are asking, how can we satisfy that appetite? How can we become part of the bigness of this boy? How can we contribute to its size? This is a good American. Contribute to America's greatness. When one country consumes more than 50% of the world's resources, when people in this world are dying because they're not eating enough, because other people are dying because they're eating too much, the ethical response is not, how can we share in all of this overeating? And so, what are we? There are these kids in the house, in the two-third world, the kids in the underclasses of this society, on the edges. And the dominant quest of Muslims is, how do I become a part of this consuming body? And how can I distance myself from the screaming kids all around me? I'm one of those siblings, but I want to distance myself from these screaming kids. And so it's not about it's not about blacks in the inner city. It's not about women that are being abused in their homes. It's not about Latinos. I'm living on campus this semester, and so I'm in my office very late, and I'm becoming aware more and more of another group of people that live on campus, the Latino workers. They come in quietly at night. They don't speak English. They try to avoid your eyes, to make eye contact with you. A completely other world on campus. But that's not our concern. It's common cause with people in the inner cities, with homelessness, with workers in our factories, with our own cab drivers. Those aren't our concerns. Our major concern is, how do we become a part of this pattern of consumption? How do we become a part of the beast? And in our attempts to become a part of the beast, we are prepared to turn our faith upside down, inside out, and find all sorts of new understandings of Islam, reinterpreting Islam. It's liberal Islam, it's progressive Islam, it's modernist Islam, it's moderate Islam, all sorts of things we are coming up with. But really at the heart of it, we have made it to America, and now how do we make it in America? The last story that I want to tell is the story of a restaurant. And so, we have this restaurant. Let's call it an Indonesian restaurant. Indonesian cuisine is very particular, spread over a large area. You get different kinds of Indonesian cuisines also. So, a group of people walk in one day, very strong, very powerful, well-dressed and so on. And there they come in and they demand hamburgers. Hamburgers? Sorry, you know, this is an Indonesian restaurant. We don't have hamburgers. Oops. The restaurant owner immediately recognizes, wait. There's more to it than just this hamburgers and so on. Rushes into the kitchen, demands that the kitchen produces hamburgers. And so, oops. Kitchen staff, oh, what the hell, you know, we're Indonesian, specializing in Indonesian cuisine, but let's turn the things upside down, inside out, we'll produce these hamburgers for them. And so, the appetite at that moment was for hamburgers. And then after a while, they come in and they demand some kind of pasta. Pasta, Indonesian cuisine, but now the rest of the kitchen has been changed a bit. The kitchen has been changed to create all these hamburgers and so on, not exactly for pastas. And quickly the restaurant owner upside down, inside out again, and here they produce this pasta for this very powerful crowd. And so they came into Muslim societies a couple of years ago, and they demanded jihad on the menu. There was a struggle with the communists in Afghanistan, and what did we do? We turned our faith upside down, inside out. Dragged all of those verses out on jihad, and we gave them jihad. And we collected money all over the Muslim world. We set up offices in Chicago, set up offices in New York, set up offices in London. And Ya ayyuhan nabiyyu harrid al-mu'minina ala al-qital. O Prophet, spur the believers on to battle. وَقْتُلُوهُمْ حَيْثُ تَقِفْتُمُوهُمْ وَأَخْرِجُوهُمْ مِنْ حَيْثُ أَخْرَجُوكُمْ. Drive them out where they've, and fight them wherever you find them. Drive them out from where they've driven you out of. All of those verses we invoked. You want jihad? Fine. Saudis paid for it. The Americans provided all the training. This is the appetite of the empire. After a couple of years, communism is slayed. All those beasts that were created under all of this jihad rhetoric, hare yaar, kya kare ab unke saath? What to do with them now? Pas gaya hai, trapped. Ha, okay. No. Go into the restaurant now. Now you demand peace. Tell the restaurant owner we want peace. And now the syllabuses of madrasas must be changed. Islam means peace. And the ISNA program changes. Islam is peace. And we come up with books. The Quran is the same as the United States Constitution. If you look at Islam properly, really properly, then Islam, Islamic values and American values are identical values. Kwanzaa values, which values? The values of war, the values of genocide, the values of dispossession, which Americans? The American workers, the immigrants in this country, the taxi drivers in this country, or the doctors, the engineers, the wealthy people, and all those who... And so, my brothers and sisters, but this restaurant, before I conclude, this restaurant, the problem is that this restaurant itself employs slave labor. And so the restaurant owner is in cahoots with the owners. But inside the restaurant, they cannot offer a coherent response to what is happening on the outside to the attack, because we are employing slave labor inside our own communities. The marginalization of women inside our mosques, the marginalization of black people inside our communities and inside our conferences, the domination of Islam in this country by immigrant Muslims from the Southeast Asian continent and so on, our inability to create space for others and othernesses in our own community. No, it's about power. And so our own home inside is in a mess. So the struggle then is to address both the external colonialism as well as the authoritarianism that happens inside our communities. Until now, our theology has been a theology of positionalism. It's not Islam that we're interested in. How do we position Muslims? The positioning of Muslims. Positioning of Muslims in relation to power. Islam, like all other religions, there is not a single prophet, brothers and sisters, who came into this world, whose essential question was, how do I fit in with power? Ek ye peygamber bata do. Show me one prophet who came into this world and whose fundamental question was, how do I fit in with power? And I don't care what you want to call your prophet. You can call him Buddha. You can call your prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Not one prophet came into this world and his essential question was, how do I fit in with power? Prophethood, prophetic religion, is about resistance. It is about opposing power. It is about making common cause with the least. وَنُرِيدُ أَن نَمُنَّ عَلَى الَّذِينَ اسْتُضْعِفُوا فِي الْأَرْضِ وَنَجْعَلَهُمُ الْأَئِمَّةِ وَنَجْعَلَهُمُ الْوَارِثِينَ وَنُمَكِّنَ لَهُمْ فِي الْأَرْضِ وَنُرِيَ فِرْعَوْنَ وَهَامَانَ وَجُنُودَهُمَا مِنْهُمْ مَا كَانُوا يَحْذَرُونَ. And it is our promise to bestow our grace on those who have been marginalized in the earth and to make them the leaders. وَنُرِيَ فِرْعَوْنَ وَهَامَانَ وَجُنُودَهُمَا مِنْهُمْ مَا كَانُوا يَحْذَرُونَ. And to show Fir'aun and Haman the realization of their fears. You fear the loss of power? God will show you the loss of power. And so, brothers and sisters, the choice is really ours. To be Muslims, it's not just good enough. There are certain inevitable sociological processes that this country will go through and that communities will go through as immigrant communities. But there is what I sometimes, and I want to be very clear, I have no tuck with anti-Semitism. But there is a process that I sometimes describe as the Jewification of Muslims in the United States, whereby the community becomes the only form that we are interested in. How do we promote the community? Some time ago I delivered a lecture in New York. It was the Rudin lecture, and Mr. Rudin is one of the great financial powers in New York, and he was at the lecture himself. It was a bit of a sophisticated lecture. He didn't understand much about what I had to say, but he asked the chairperson afterwards, was it good for the Jews? Was it good for the Jews? And so for most Jews in this country, this is the primary question: was it good for the Jews? It's not about, is it in consonant, is it consistent with the ethical values of Judaism? And so the primary question for Muslims in this country is becoming, is it good for the Muslims? Muslims is a sociological category. Muslims is another bunch of people. There is a faith that we belong to. And at the core of this faith is a God that we say we worship. And Allah is bigger than this faith that we worship. But this faith that we adhere to is bigger than the sociological community. And so this is the shirk. This is the heresy of religion. When you place a community as the core of what you are all about, instead of your values and what you believe. And so there are certain processes that are happening, and it's perhaps inevitable. But as somebody that stands on the edges, of Isna, on the edges of American society, on the edges in my own theological thinking, we have a responsibility to ask, do we go for this theology of positionalism, or do we go for a prophetic religion that is rooted in the concerns of people at the edges? This was a hadith of the Prophet. Oh Allah, let me live amongst people at the bottom. Raise me on the day of judgment. Let me die amongst people at the bottom. And on the day of judgment, raise me amongst people at the bottom. And so, brothers and sisters, is our quest a desperation to be invited to the banquet of Fir'aun, to be a partner in Fir'aun's games and so on, and compete with each other in getting into Fir'aun's good books? Or is our battle one of struggling to find what our Islam means in the lives and struggles of people on the edges of society, people who are dying of hunger, people who are there because of their race, because of their color or their gender? Wa shukran.
I hope the two people who came to listen to Fadil Saq are well, very well rewarded. Now, sorry for not counting correctly, four people. I now request Dr. Ingrid Madsen to make her presentation. I have already introduced her.
Assalamu alaikum. A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alamin was salatu was salam ala sayyidina Muhammad wa ala alihi wa ashabihi ajma'in. Well, how many people enjoyed the fact that Imam Farid gave a talk at ISNA this year? All right. Let me just say that a little bit about how this kind of thing happens, because you have to feel empowered in your community and in this organization. The program of this convention is put together by the program committee. By the way, I happen to be program chair this year. But that program committee is appointed by the Majlis. The Majlis of the Islamic Society of North America is an elected body. Anyone who is a Muslim, 18 years or older, living in North America, can be a member of the Islamic Society of North America. You don't have to go through any kind of mihna. There's no test of your faith. It's a self-identity, it's a declaration. And by becoming a member, you will be responsible for choosing the leadership who will appoint committees, including the program committee, so you can decide who are the people you want to hear, what are the topics you want to enjoy. This kind of session, a parallel session, is constructed not by the program committee. We receive proposals from the community for parallel sessions. There are more parallel sessions than there are so-called main sessions that are constructed specifically by the program committee to fill particular gaps or address certain issues that we think are critical for this year. But you can choose these. And this is something that's been going on for about 5 years now. And every year we get more and more and more proposals, to the point that we have to reject most of them simply because of lack of space. So this is your organization. It's not my organization. Alhamdulillah, I'm almost finished my 2 terms as vice president, so I can go pay attention to some other projects I have. But this is your organization, so I want you to take control over that. And, you know, this isn't a membership drive, but I'm just saying that if we want to have some control and have some sense of empowerment, this is simply an organization that's a platform for self-expression for Muslims in North America, to get to know each other, to hear each other's voices, to understand. We need to have that platform. And inshallah, with your participation, it will grow and expand, and we will be able to have the confidence to listen to each other. And I really want to thank Dr. Fareed for coming here. He's been a courageous voice, a creative thinker for our community, and you know, certainly, I'm sure, you know, my 16-year-old daughter agrees with about 5% of what I say, so I don't expect the Muslim community to agree on everything. That's not the point. We need to get to know each other. We need to hear from each other. So I know you have to leave soon, and I'm very grateful that you came here to speak to us today. I wish we could just sit and listen to him more and more. Is there going to be time for you to answer questions?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, we want to leave it.
Okay, so how much time? When does he have to leave?
We have about 10 minutes at 12 o'clock.
Okay. Okay, so I'm going to make it very short. You have other opportunities to hear from me. Let me just say a few things. First of all, this is an important topic for me because one of the things, it's an issue that I've been very concerned about. I don't know if I could say before I was a Muslim, because that's a kind of theological argument about when I became a Muslim. But I've been involved in worker issues my whole life. I grew up on singing union songs in Canada with my family, and it's an issue that's really touches my heart. And I've been distressed to see that it is not a priority in the Muslim community. We are an educated community. By and large, the immigrants who came, especially in the 60s and 70s, were professionals. So the consciousness really wasn't there. In the late 80s and 90s, we have had more refugee populations. And I believe that perhaps they're helping us maybe gather greater awareness of these issues. The Bosnians who came, the Somalians who came, by and large, were not professional communities, but have had to continue to work in service industries. And maybe when we see their faces reflected on the other side of the counter, we start to become a little bit aware of these people who are working for us as human beings. But that is not acceptable. The idea that somehow we have a responsibility only to Muslims is an unethical position. We are responsible for those people whose lives touch us. And one of the things that I find hopeful about the Muslim community is that we aren't parochial. So in the sense that we do have, many of us have ties with other countries. I increasingly feel like an immigrant to the United States. At first when I came from Canada, I didn't, but I feel like the countries have separated in many ways that I really do feel like I'm from a very different kind of place. But we have that sense that there are people in other places, and we travel, and we need to bring that awareness to our sense of priorities in our communities. The reality is that the sad reality, and I just want to bring a few hard facts home, is that we go into mosques, Islamic centers, and we find that there are cleaning people who are not being paid minimum wage. We find that there are people who are being hired on an hourly wage who are not given any kind of benefits. The federal minimum wage in this country is someone who is not involved in workers' issues. I would like a physician who knows what the federal minimum wage is to say that. $5.15 an hour. If you work a 40-hour work week, that is, how much are you making a week? $206 a month, $824 a month in the United States. When I was watching the news about the Katrina hurricane, remember that the airplanes were grounded just before it hit. And I watched on the news, there was a man who was there whose airplane was grounded. So he made the sacrifice of going to his ATM and taking out $1,000 to pay for a cab driver to drive him and his wife to Atlanta. He had $1,000 in his bank account that he could go and withdraw to pay for his escape. He withdrew in that one time more money than thousands of people in New Orleans make in 1 month. And that's 824 before any kind of deductions or anything else. I mean, really, to think about it. Think about the money that we're spending here. I mean, the immorality of that situation in the United States should really offend us. It should make us realize that many of these tragedies that we keep blaming on God and look at them as sort of, you know, signs of God's power, which they are also signs that we have been negligent and deficient and haven't been doing our job, because people were left in that city because they did not have not $1,000 for a cab, but they didn't have $50 to pay for the gas to drive out of town. In fact, they didn't have a car to drive out of town, and no one was providing buses for them or any escape. So this is really our moral dilemma, and the Muslim community is a generous community, but we have not been very well educated in terms of our priorities and our ethical obligations. I have a lot of hope and optimism for our community because we are generous. And we see that when we ask people to give, they do give. And there are studies that have been done that show, comparing the American Muslim community with communities, other faith-based communities, and the American Muslim community is the most generous community in terms of charitable giving. So this isn't just to, you know, beat us down or say that we're no good. We have that good intention, that soft heart compassion, but we have not been well educated. We have not, our leaders have not done a good job in establishing our priorities for action. And there are huge ethical gaps, especially when it comes to workers and our relationship with working people. I know there are many people who call this Isna weekend, but this is Labor Day weekend. Okay? It is Labor Day weekend. Monday is Labor Day. And if we don't acknowledge and recognize all of those people who have made this weekend possible, then we are being ungrateful. We are not being the people who are thankful to others, and by doing so, being thankful to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So we need to do that. And just finally, I'd like to give one example of how we've been poorly educated and why we've ended up in this situation that we're in. The issue of zakat. I I mean, I have heard so many lectures and read so many articles on how zakat is the solution to all human suffering and poverty. This is completely incorrect, and it's no Muslim scholar ever, you know, said that zakat was the solution to eradicating poverty. There are two kinds of poverty. There is structural poverty, structural inequality, and there's incidental poverty, or tragedies or events that happen to people in their life. The kind of tragedy and events are things like a woman's husband dies, she's left with four kids, she's a widow. Children, their parents perish in the tsunami, they're left, thousands of families left desolate. Someone becomes handicapped on their job. Now, in those cases, zakat does a wonderful job of filling in the gap to help that family along who's in that situation. Now, you can also create social structures to lessen that blow. So it doesn't have to be an individualized, here, I'll give you money every month, but you set up foundations so that really these people can receive the support and help that they need and dignity. But that does nothing to address problems that are created by the fact that no employer in this country, in a state that only meets federal minimum wage, does not have to pay more than $5.15 an hour to their employee. No, zakat does not solve that problem. Zakat does not solve the problem of our tax dollars being used to build super highways out to the suburbs so that wealthy people can take their comfortable cars and drive downtown or to their place of work very quickly and comfortably. But if you live on the south side of Chicago, if you can get to your work downtown on the bus in 2 hours, you're happy about that. From Naperville, anyone here from Naperville? So Naperville, fourth largest city in Illinois. If you take the train from Naperville, wealthy suburb, to downtown Chicago, you can get downtown in 35 minutes on that train. How many people on the south side of Chicago who are in neighborhoods can really find their way to work in that amount of time? They can't. And that is a choice that we are making. So when we go and talk to the powerful people in Washington and we are deciding what our priorities are, do we ever bring this as a priority? A fair distribution of the wealth and the infrastructure so that all of those people who are taking care of us, and this is a wealthy community, we enjoy good meals at nice restaurants, we have, frankly, embarrassingly large homes that are being cleaned by others, we're not doing our job. And let me say that women are not off the hook. You know, it's not sufficient, and this is my final comment, for women to claim to be an oppressed class. There is gender oppression, and that has to be dealt in those terms. But women are also divided by class. And there are working women in our community and American society at large who are enjoying the best aspects of consumer society at the expense of other women. Women who have to leave their children alone without any proper supervision because they are getting paid so little that they need to work a 10-hour day taking care of your children and your house rather than a reasonable day where they could get home and help their children with their homework after school. So I want to say, especially as a woman to other women, because we always look, you know, just as Muslims generally try to blame all our problems on the oppression that Muslims suffer from others, as women we can't simply play the gender card and look at our oppression and not look at the way that we participate in a system that continues to disempower our sisters who have much less opportunity than we do. With that, I'll end, and inshallah, we'll have some time for discussion. Assalamu alaikum.
Thank you very much, Sister, for the introduction. We have about 15 to 20 minutes for questions and answers. I will request the brothers and sisters who have some questions to come forward so that the speakers can hear the question. I don't think we have any microphones here in the hall.
They could use this mic. Oh, there's a mic on the floor.
Oh, there's a mic on the floor. But please make sure that your questions are very short, because there will be so many people who are interested in asking questions. And I also expect that the speaker's panelist's answers will be equally short.
Can I just make one quick announcement while people are thinking about their questions as Zarqa Nawaz is walking out of the room? There is a film festival in room 49 upstairs. It's beginning at 2 p.m. And we, Zarqa Nawaz, a filmmaker from Canada, is here airing the American premiere of a documentary called Me and the Mosque. I wanted to make sure it was in the right order. This is a fantastic documentary chronicling the struggles that Muslim women have had in Canada, accessing their rightful place in the mosque. It's a very creative, inspiring, sometimes depressing, but in the end, a hopeful documentary that had funding from the National Film Board of Canada. So I urge you to check out that documentary.
Thank you. There are a couple of written questions, so why don't...
While Ingrid,
go ahead.
While Dr. Mattson read hers, I'll just read mine. How does the Muslim community in North America walk your talk in the real world? And very interesting, it's a brother who came and spoke to me in Afrikaans, very surprisingly. I think that the details of what I say, the fine applications that what I say, has to really to be worked out by specific communities in their own kinds of contexts. I want to say two things about this walking the talk thing, and use two examples of it. The one is at a larger level of larger global issues. Take, for example, the war on Iraq. How do we as Muslims make common cause with other anti-war activists and engage in solidarity action with them and do our thing at a local level and at a national level? But it's not only drama that infuses us. So there's drama in Iraq and then we get all excited. And then we see bulldozing of homes on the West Bank and then we get excited. Can we get the Muslims... I think that there are also the tests of whether we're really committed to the values that we're talking about. It's also an ongoing kind of activism. And here I want to talk about, I didn't get to know your name.
Christine?
Yes. Yeah, I want to talk about, Christine and the nice T-shirt that Christine gave me before the meeting and the work that Junaid was doing and during the summer with the Interfaith Worker Justice Network. How do we get involved in an organization like this that draws upon the resources of each of these different religions, see what we have in common with each other, not necessarily for our own narrow class goals now, but goals for others? So there are many, many such organizations in our communities that operate at the national level. We as Muslims need to just get out of our shyness, out of our reticence, and the kind of arrogance that when we enter into these things, we have the answers. We also step into those forums with the intention of both providing our Islamic insights into these things, but a willingness to learn where do they come from and what do we learn about their insights into the problem that we have. But at the end of the day, it's a combination of both getting engaged in national issues that do prevent drama, that's also important. In 2 weeks' time, there is this huge march in Washington, D.C., against the war. But because it's not about Palestine, I don't know if there are going to be too many Muslims there. I'm going to be there. I hope many of you can make it there. But besides the drama, we also need to find those quiet, often unrewarding things that doesn't get glamour, no TV coverage in our local areas. But each one of us have to define for ourselves what those are in our areas. So two things, in solidarity with others, and at the same time continuing to draw resources from who we are as Muslims.
Thank you. Sister.
So this question says, capitalism and Western democracy are the problems in the whole world today. what should be done about it?
What should be
well,
done
maybe,
about it in
maybe,
1 minute?
Maybe we should wait for the Mahdi to come and usher in a new era. I think that looking for the essential problem, for the, you know, the evil doer, the responsible person or social structure or political structure that is at the root of the matter is mostly a distraction from what we need to do. When we talk about structural injustice and systematic problems, we do have to be aware of the role of the IMF and the World Bank and all of these kind of things. But, you know, our role as Muslims is not to create another kind of utopian political system that we are going to work for about 80 years for and fight among ourselves about the different dimensions of it and in the end come up with some kind of grand project that's never implemented. I think that what we need to do is to look at ourselves, look at our ethics, and as we as was said in the description of this program, make some alliances. I mean, the step is to start working on the injustice that we see in a reasonable way. And in this respect, this is something that I've written about, we need to engage both on the individual and communal level. As individuals, we all have our small oppressions and injustices that we commit every day to our own families, to the people that we work with, to the people we encounter. So, of course, we have to purify ourselves and address those small injustices. But there are things that cannot be accomplished without others that need to be done as a collectivity. That is the Islamic category of a fard kifaya, and that if we don't engage in attempting to rectify these injustices, our whole community will bear the burden of sin. It doesn't mean that we have to have solved them. We're never going to solve all the problems, so we're not going to topple, you know, global capitalism. But if we don't make a collective effort to do it, then we're never going to get anywhere. And let me just say that I really believe that the traditional concept of a fard kifaya needs to be expanded beyond the Muslim community. Because in today's world, we cannot accomplish those goals without being in alliance with other people of good faith. It is impossible. So that if we say, no, we only should be in alliance with Muslims, then basically we're saying we really aren't serious. We really don't mean it. So that is our obligation. To find those people, to make those alliances, and work towards changing those things that are unfair a little bit at a time.
Thank you very much.
Yeah,
there's a question
on the
floor.
On the floor, so let's get to the
way. It works. Anyone else who has a question? Dear. Junaid.
Shakila.
Yeah, it's working. Go ahead.
You brought up a couple of very excellent points, and I would just like further commentary in regards to the fact that, yes, the Muslim community is in terms of funds, but it is probably one of the least generous in terms of actually giving their time in volunteering to social issues, whether it be in the community that they live, and even at times in terms of the programs that can be furthered through the... And I think in order for us to really make an impact, you brought up a key point that we must build those alliances, but then we also must give our time and energy to whether it be homeless shelters, whether it be feeding the poor, pension programs, and even looking at the program, I really don't, about the program, I don't see a lot of things that actually have us mobilizing ourselves and our time, from spending time at lunches or social gatherings to actually doing work in the greater community that we live. And I would just like maybe your assessment as to why that is not the case, and what is it that we can do in order to mobilize our men, women, and children?
I'd say there's three reasons. One reason is that, first of all, much of our community is still in the process of institution building. There are many communities that are still building mosques, and when we look at the churches in those communities, they have churches that were built 80 years ago. They added to them with their daycare, their soup kitchen, little by little. So to that extent, I'll give us a bit of a break and say that we have so much energy that's being devoted to still creating institutions and building the basic infrastructure of our faith community that it takes a lot of time and energy. But I won't, that's the break that I'll give. On the other hand, I have to say that our community wastes a lot of time. We are one of, I'm sure, I haven't done any statistics on this, but we are huge consumers. On the class level, for those who aren't busy working, you know, and many of the recent refugees and immigrants are just working all the time. So that's one thing. But for those who are have the means, who are established here, a lot of time is being spent just consuming things. And the reality is that, and I know the difference having lived in different size, you know, apartments and homes, that the bigger your house gets, the less time you have to do anything else. I mean, even if you have other people cleaning it, you have to manage the home and manage those people and manage those things. So that's an ethical choice. When you choose to live in a certain kind of home, a certain kind of, you know, floor space, you are making a choice about how you're going to spend your time. That's an ethical decision. And then the third thing, as Imam Farid said, is that there's a question of shyness and a fear that sometimes we, you know, we're afraid of how other people will receive us. Will they welcome us? Will they welcome our participation? And to that extent, we need to help each other, encourage each other to make those links.
Thank you. There's time for a couple of questions. We'll go first there, and then you have decided to? Okay.
You should take all, three questions.
All three questions? Okay. One, but two, be three. Very brief, please.
Yeah, inshallah. I just thought, first, to thank both panelists for their wonderful. My question directed to Imam Farid. JazakAllah for your speech. It was very...
Yeah.
If you can just elaborate more about concerning... Yes, we are not supposed to try to go to the... or to fit within power or to go to the round table. Also, how we can be more closer to the society at large. My second quick question is concerning when you talk about... the wrong question, I mean, we should not be asking whether it is good for Muslims, but whether it is according to our ethics. I think we should be more, if you can elaborate more, does that mean that there is some contradiction between our ethics and what is good for Muslims? Or maybe we should review what this means, that something is good for Muslims. Mm-hmm. Human life.
Could we get another question before... Yes.
We can only take two more.
The mic, so they can hear. They have to hear. Go ahead.
You can't ask afterwards. I leave when the talk is over.
Yeah, yeah. Go ahead and ask, sister.
You gave an interview, Mother Jones, mother living in his house. Could you tell a story?
Well, thanks for that. I can't do it. It's, I don't have enough.
Third question.
Assalamu alaikum. I totally disagree with Muslims being the very generous. They are the very stingy and very miser. There is not any statistics.
There is.
They done a survey. That Muslim, I tell you what, my observation is only 20% of the Muslims pay their proper zakah. 80% pay a little bit, and most of them even don't know how to calculate zakah. And what's the alternative? You pay, we pay our taxes and to the IRS, and the IRS says, no, it's not enough, pay us more or pay us less. Is there any institution in Islam that tells, hey, where you paid the zakat, how do you know you have paid the proper zakat? Can we just tell you, can work as IRS tells you, no, you have not paid zakat properly, you have to pay this much. Is there anything like this we have, or can we have?
Two questions first. Okay.
Junaid, you listen to the chair, you don't just take the mic around.
Okay. If your question can be finished in 2 seconds, please. 3 seconds.
Thank you very much for this presentation. We usually talk about negative aspects, but I would like to raise a positive aspect from the community here in Chicago. In fact, Muslims in Chicago got involved with a group called the United Power. I don't know if you know about it. It is a social group who raised issues of the real problems of the poor people and the working class people and the Muslims that did actually good presentation in well organized, plastic way, and they raised their own issue also about we pay charity, we usually afraid that we may be listed in blacklist or something like that,
yes.
And we raise the issue charity without fear.
Yeah.
So we put our issues and we supported other people's issues, started to work through our congressmen, and we went to the capital and we did the positive actually.
Thank you very much. I know the how much in Chicago 3 seconds can extend.
Okay, just a quick response. I'm quoting a survey, Faith Communities Today, a survey of 40 national denominations that was conducted by the Hartford Institute for Religion Research. So that is is where the facts are on Muslim charitable giving compared to other communities. Doesn't mean we can't give more. And with respect to calculating, ISNA has a Zakat calculation worksheet. It's on a CD. You could put it on your computer along with the will kit. You can get it free if you become an ISNA member, or you can get it, I think, for a token amount.
Thank you. Brother, we'll answer the two questions.
I'm also afraid, but after my questions, I would love to have meet some friends. I don't know if Zain is still there, a number of other friends. I'm flying off to Europe from the back door. So I'd have to be leaving immediately after this. My apologies that I can't stay further. just a response to one of the two questions. Sister, in honesty, it's a bit of a long story, and I don't think that I'm able to deal with it in the few minutes that I have available to me, so it'll have to be wait for another time. In response to the brother's question there, how do we at the same time become closer to the society at large? There is no such thing as the society at large. when we just talk about we want to identify with America, we want to become Americans, we want to identify with this society at large, who is this the America? Is it the America of Bill Riley? Is it the America of Bill Moyes? is it the America of Jerry Springer? Or is it the America of the anti-war resistors? There are many, many Americas. And so which America is this that we are identifying with, that we are working with? As Muslims, it's our responsibility to scratch below the surface and to find out the other Americas, the subversive history of this country, and the many other good Americans that are aware of that subversive history and want to undo the damages of genocide and. And so it's our challenge to find the other America. I'm not saying become an American. I am not an American, and I am speaking to most of you guys as an outsider. But I know from South Africa that there were many South Africans. There was a white South Africa and there was a black South Africa. And increasingly now there is a rich South Africa and there is a poor South Africa. So which South Africa do I want to identify with? As for, the interests of the Muslims, for example, one looks at, again, the Jewish community. many, many people, most people in the Jewish community, think that the interest of the Jewish community is identical to the interest of Zionism, and that the land and so on, if we can get the land and have control over that land, then this becomes the interest of the Jews. But there are many concerned Jews, deeply sensitive Jews, who say that no, you cannot destroy the values of Judaism. You cannot walk over another people in your quest for your own nationhood. You don't walk over a woman in order to become a man. There is a different way of becoming a man. You can be a man comfortable in your own identity without walking over a woman. And so, what is a Muslim? What are good for the Muslims? These things are being defined and redefined all the time. It's like the ads on TV. This is good for you. Buy this. You know, you have never imagined
what it is to relieve yourself in the toilet without this kind of toilet that we have to offer you. We'll make your toilet experience a really pleasurable experience. Never. So we can, yeah. And so what ways are there of being? And so what I am saying is ways of being Muslim and promoting how we can be, what it means. These are being this thing all the time. And now a good Muslim citizen is now being couched in a certain way. These are the good Muslims. And TV is telling us who are the good Muslims. The administration are telling us who are the good Muslims. Muslim organizations buying into all of this are telling us who are the good Muslims. And those are the bad Muslims. Now they may be bad, but we may be good. But I am saying that there is an ethical criteria in Islam. An ethical criteria that does not accept our essential identity as consumers. But as human beings responsible to God, there is an ethical criteria of justice to those inside our own communities and justice towards others. And these are the things that really make us Muslims. Not a biological accident of being born in a Muslim Pakistani family or being born in an Indonesian Muslim family. These are biological accidents. And on the day of judgment, ultimately we are accountable not for which community we belonged to, but we are accountable for how we lived out our lives and how we lived out our values. One last little point that I want to make is the task may seem enormous in front of us. Bloody hell, you're talking about worker justice. In the last years, you know, union membership has fallen dramatically. How do we work with workers in the middle of this Walmartization of our lives? At the end of the day, it is something that Ingrid said, that it's not what we're going to accomplish that is going to matter. Our responsibility as religious people is not to accomplish. Our responsibility as religious people is to do in terms of our capacity. كل يعمل على شاكلته. To act in terms of our capacity. Accomplishment is divine. Accomplishment belongs to God. Accomplishment does not belong to human beings. You know, there is a story, and I want to end on this, of a woman. It's part of Muslim mythology. There is a woman who was seen going to the market when Nabi Yusuf was being sold as a slave. And she had a bale of wool in her hand. And she was asked, where are you going to? And she said, I'm going to the market to buy Yusuf out, to bail Yusuf out, to set him free. I had a dream that God's servant was being sold on the market as an ordinary slave. And I'm going to buy him. And you, and what capital? The person asked her. She said, me and this bale of wool. And the person laughed at her. And she said, on the day of judgment, let it not be said that God's servant was being sold on the market as a slave, and I did not do what I could to liberate that slave. And so at the end of the day, it's not about achievement, it's about what we do.